Welcome to Local Talk on KHRY Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Paul Wearson, one of your hosts for today, and my good friend Howard Hammond is my co-host. Hello, Howard.
Well, hello, Paul. Hello, everyone. It's good to be here in the studio with you.
Now, they call Howard Mr. Slater, and that's a good thing, because this is a big moment, a big time of year for Slater, with the 4th of July coming up.
Then if you're looking at me as being a Mr. Slater, I guess you're expecting me to know something about what's going to happen on 4th of July upcoming in our community, as well as some other interesting things about our territory in southwest Story County.
And we're counting on good weather and all those things to come into play perfectly for the celebration. Yeah. And in honor of the 4th of July, we're going to hear a fife and drum version of The Star-Spangled Banner. Hey, I love that sound, a fife and drum corps, our Star-Spangled Banner. And we're going to get into our program now, and we've got two people here in the studio. We have Howard, my co-host, and of course, Howard, you can introduce our special guest today from Slater.
You bet I will, and I'm pleased to do so. Bob Krause. Bob is a longtime resident of the Slater-Shawlaw area, and currently serves as a vice president of the South Story Bank and Trust of our area of the county, and with offices both in Huxley and Slater. And Bob, the reason we have Bob with us, he's been a very influential person, not because of his position in the bank necessarily, but because of his MC responsibilities he's had for many years in our Slater 4th of July celebrations. So, Bob, glad you're here.
Thank you, Howard. Paul, appreciate the opportunity to be here. Beautiful morning in Central Iowa.
Well, let's keep it beautiful till we get to the end of the week here. I guess predictions are, I don't know who's got the biggest pull, but we've got some people praying that things will do well for us for weather come Friday night and through Saturday.
And you know, you have the fireworks on Friday night, and that's going to, well, tell us about Friday night and when you're going to kick off the celebration and just how things will be getting underway. First of all, Bob, you might tell us how you get to Slater in the first place if you want to come from out of town.
Slater is easy to get to. From Interstate 35, it's exit 102, head about 5 miles west, and you'll be in Slater. Slater is also south of the west side of Ames on R-38. Go about 10 miles south. It's a corner of Highway 210 and R-38, so it's an easy spot to get to.
Anyone can find Slater.
That's right.
And now Friday night, things get underway, and you can begin to tell us about the sequence of events as we move into that celebration.
On Friday night, we get things started off with a kiddie parade at 6 o'clock. That will be followed by a puppet show at 6:15. The kiddie parade and puppet show are going to be at Nelson Park, which is in the center of town. A lovely park. We thank our founding fathers for setting that up. Lots of big trees. Bring a lawn chair. There's plenty of shade. You'll have a wonderful evening. We follow the puppet show up with a dog show at 6:30. And then the beer tent opens at Nelson Park at 8 o'clock. That will be open from 8 to 12. We also have a teen dance at the elementary school on the northeast side of town from 6 to 9. And then the fireworks are at 10 o'clock. And if you are wanting to get close, look for the water tower in town and get close to the water tower. The fireworks will be shot off just a couple hundred yards south of the water tower. So that's the spot to be.
And I understand it's not your average fireworks display. They go all out.
Do they ever go all out? I don't know, if Bob, you're a finance person in our community. I don't know if you've been close to those that have been putting together the budget for the 4th of July, but it's not uncommon to be up to the $20,000 to $30,000 figure, and the fireworks alone, there's a $12,000 to $13,000 cost this year. So we try to do it up well because a lot of people look forward to that, which will be the Friday night at 10 o'clock fireworks.
Yep, and it'll last about 15 minutes, so it's about $1,000 a minute.
$1,000 a minute. Oh my God!
That might sound extravagant, but when it comes right down to it. There's only one 4th of July per the year, and when you got as many people, elders, I think, appreciate it as much as kids do. And so why not once a year when you spread that over a population of 1,500 people? It's not coming out of the city budget. Oh, no. But volunteers step forward, and it's a good thing.
And Benjamin Franklin said famously that they should celebrate this forever with fireworks and incendiaries. So
yeah, right. Well, there we'll point to that source.
Why we do Ben Franklin ordered
it. Ben Franklin ordered it.
Ben
right.
Franklin told us to do it.
Yeah, right. We're
so,
on to that.
So here we are doing fireworks and all over the state of Iowa. Friday night it'll be happening at 10 o'clock at Slater, yep. And mm-hmm. Talk about some of the ways that this celebration sort of evolved. You have Sheldahl and Slater, and you have two communities there that sort of. Go together in some way, don't they?
You're right, Paul. We sometimes say it's a sister city arrangement. Actually, Sheldahl formerly had the first celebrations, and they were holding it on even-numbered years. Then Slater came onto the scene once we incorporated it into it, and we've got photos of some of the very first 4th of July parades and celebrations. So historic, it's been historic for our two cities, and Slater's had their... up to about 5 years ago, we always did it on the odd number of years. Now, Sheldahl being a city of 300 to 400 people and Slater 1,500 people, it's sometimes hard to get all the volunteers out it takes to put on a good celebration. So I'm not negating Sheldahl's situation, but we have done pretty well with Slater proceeding on the celebrations on the every year now.
And I'm sure that Sheldahl people are represented on the committee. They have some people on leadership roles that are also from Sheldahl.
Precisely. Working together.
That's important because you have this dual history of these two communities. And I know from my own experience in my community, all the phone calls and organizational effort to go into planning this sort of an activity and the many kinds of projects and activities that interrelate and overlap. And so it's a real planning issue, and a lot of people have to care very much to coordinate this.
Correct. And I might say that everybody in the community, firemen with the fireworks and the organizations hopping in, the business groups, the financial support is tremendous. And you couldn't pull it off with a city of our size and suggesting that other communities have like-type celebrations all over our county. And we know, too, that Ames has a celebration on the 4th of July. So on our county is, I think, doing a good job of putting that before the people.
It takes a lot of people, and we just want to thank so many people within the town for helping out, pitching in.
Precisely. Is there any thought in reviewing some of the things that are going to happen that day?
On Friday night, you have several things happening. You have things getting underway at 4 o'clock, actually. Inflatables by G. Willie. That's tell. I think I know about inflatables. It's for the kids and immature adults, right?
Well, the quickie is there's fewer and fewer... the standard folks that have the what do you want to call
carnivals.
It? Carnival. Yeah. Yeah, it's tough to get carnivals to come, so the inflatables are doing a good job for us.
And it's for the kids anyway, and the young kids, mostly. They love to play on those inflatables.
You got it. that puts it together.
So we just have a wristband admittance. They can buy a wristband, and then they can play on all the inflatables.
Then you have the beer tent and a video game truck. What is that, a video game truck?
Well, it's I believe it's a semi-trailer that's full of video games, and so kids can give your kid a roll of quarters and let them go into the game truck, and they'll have a good time.
So it's a modern-day arcade.
Yes. Yeah,
mobile.
On wheels. Yeah.
On mobile, yeah.
And you have food vendors all over the city. I suppose community organizations such as service clubs, they have stands and a variety of food.
Boy Scouts, the American Legion, the local churches. Some local food vendors. Dave Hallett is always there. Smokey D's Barbecue. The Methodist Church from Sheldahl has homemade ice cream and toppings, and it's a really good. The 4-H kids, it's excellent.
Well, that's good to hear because I love food, and there's a variety of food, and all of it is not necessarily health food. Maybe Dr. Oz would not smile on these food stands, but they're just fun and flavorful. And then you have a kiddies parade too, right?
Yep. That starts off Friday night.
I've always had my dream of having a kid with me and all dressed as a kid, and the kid goes as the retired person. Wouldn't that be a good parade entry?
That'd be a switcheroo.
It would be. It would probably involve him shaving his head, even though I'm not bald, but you got to look the part, you know. So that would be fun. And this is going to be a great activity, a great opportunity for people to come to Slater and observe the 4th of July. Now, what else is going on Friday night? I see a teen dance is going to be going on, a dog show.
Yeah, to let you know how things happen in committee work, a couple months ago, somebody said, holy smokes. Well, some of them said worse than that. But they said, we haven't sufficiently provided for the teens. We better get some people, and some people from Sheldahl agreed they'd come in and help out with that. So there's an organized teen dance, and that'll be held at Ballard West, which is the elementary center of the two centers we have in the Ballard District. And so it could be inside, no worry about rain, and we're looking forward to youth, because how can you get people charged up for 4th of July in future years if you don't involve the youth in your planning? So that's kind of the essence, Paul.
Yeah, that's right. They buy into that, and they remember that from their teen years. And then they have the opportunity to be adults and carry on for the next generation.
You got it. The other thing's Friday night. You got to realize in our small community, the organizations and businesses in the city romp into this activity. And so after the kiddie parade, the local library puts on a puppet show, followed by our local veterinarian who puts on a dog show and prizes, et cetera. So it's a collaborative activity.
And that takes care of Friday. Now we get into Saturday. And, Bob, I bet you have a role on Saturday, don't you?
You bet. Parade kicks off at 10 o'clock, so that's always a big event. We estimate, Howard, help me out, isn't there usually 15,000 to 20,000 people in town for the parade?
Probably not to the 1,000 ranks, Bob, but I guess we can brag on having 2,000 to 3,000 or 4,000, yeah.
Oh,
on
really?
That, on that parade.
Now, see, I'm a fisherman, Howard, so you can say 2,000 to 3,000. I'll stick with my 15,000 to 20,000.
Okay. Well, now you never know how many drones and how many helicopters and hot air balloons are going to appear. See, okay. I forget that.
Well, and we usually have a flyover to start the parade. Do you know, are we having that again this year?
I think that's a secret, Bob. We weren't supposed to tell.
We're not supposed to tell.
Oh, goodness.
There may or may not be then.
Correct.
Okay.
I guess we got an alibi out. It's probably going to depend on upon the weather.
Okay.
Well, I have to say, here goes a personal note. I hope their listeners will forgive this. For a few years, my son was the commander of the Iowa Air National Guard. Not that he had any favorite cities of the state, but we are able to arrange his flyover with the F-16s, which is kind of dynamic at the time. But now he's retired, so I guess we'll have to go with helicopters or whatever else.
Well, it's always a fun way to start the parade. But it's a big parade. Parade will run an hour or better. Beer tent opens at 11. Beer tents also open on Friday night. There'll be a DJ. This year we're going with, for the kids, inflatables. You've seen those blow-up slides and climbing mountains and all sorts of. We're having a whole bunch of those this year brought in for the kids. There's a bicycle poker run starting off, a horseshoe tournament. So that's always kind of fun. Now, the horseshoe tournament, that's over at Grimm Park, which is over on the west side of town, closer to where the fireworks will be shot off on Friday night. A mud volleyball tournament, we've had that for a number of years. That's been very successful. I know my kids have played in that a number of years. Fortunately, they haven't asked me to participate, but they've done that. That's a lot of fun, and that's fun to watch. You can tell when that's over and those folks start heading back to Nelson Park, you see a lot of muddy, wet youth coming back in T-shirts and shorts. Of course, bingo from 1 to 3 at the beer tent. That's always fun. We have a game truck with video games. That will be there Friday night and all day, Saturday from 5 to 9. The beer tent on Saturday opens up from 8 to 12. Since the fireworks are going to be on Friday night, we expect a big crowd Saturday night in the beer tent. That's weather should be ideal. And again, it's just a great time for friends to get together and spend the evening, and it's in Slater, weather should be perfect.
Now, I'm going to be rude and interrupt you, Bob. Give you a chance to catch your breath.
Okay.
You rattled on there. That's pretty good stuff.
I do that. I'm sorry.
You've
been known to do that once or twice, too.
Yeah, we're in the same boat there. Gotcha. Well, turns out the reason I wanted to do that, Bob, he's going to cite a few activities into the evening starting about, let's say about 6-7 o'clock in there. Anyway, on the official program, and Bob, for many, many years, he may be able to tell you, but not many people could. He's done a great job of master ceremonies through the afternoon and evening on the things that are going on there. So, with that lead, Bob, give us a word on the evening, afternoon, evening, how that's going to run down.
Well, right after the parade, we have our opening ceremonies, and that typically starts at noon. The mayor will be there. They'll welcome all of our friends to the town. We have a guest speaker. That's Kyle Munson this year. We're excited to hear Kyle speak. Howard, you had a big part in getting Kyle here. Appreciate that.
Now, he's the columnist from the Register.
Right.
Yes.
A little insertion here, if you don't mind. We're pleased to have Kyle, as anybody would when you get that. But he gives us no favors because he's a Slaterite, and he writes columns regularly in the Des Moines Register. His wife, Ann, is a council person in our town. So we've got folks like that to turn to make our programming super duper. Take it from there, Bob.
Well, in the afternoon, it's always a lot of fun, and the weather should be good. After the parade, we probably have a half a dozen different food vendors. So once the parade is over, come to Nelson Park, get yourself something to eat, and then sit down for an afternoon of great entertainment. We start with our community band and chorus at 1 o'clock. They'll perform for about an hour and a half. All local folks from our Ballard community, they do an unbelievable job. They really do well. They practice really hard. Starting at 2:30, we have the Slater's Got Talent show. I'm just amazed every year at the local youth and others that come up on stage and perform, from dancers. We've had skateboarders, a lot of singers, vocalists, guitar players. They come up anywhere from 3 to mid-70s will come up on stage and sing, and that's a great job. At 4:30, we have a hypnotist. We've done that for a number of years, and that's always very popular, a really entertaining show to watch. Then starting at 6 o'clock, we jump into a bit more of a country mode. Riley Peterson and Wyatt Jameson are fiddlers. Riley Peterson is the son of Dr. Kirk Peterson, that lives just outside of town. Riley has won a number of awards at the state fair for his fiddling. Does an excellent job. I've seen him on IPTV on the state fair show in years past. 6:30, the Fiddle Chicks come. That is a family. Howard, yep. You know a lot about the Fiddle Chicks.
Yeah, I just to enter in just a little bit, Bob, right? Both Riley and Wyatt Jamerson that you mentioned are state contestant fiddlers. And also, these two young chaps were instructed by Michelle Bell. That's a Bell family band. And they're very talented. They were with us last year, and then had It came back by popular demand. So there's a mother and her three daughters and son, and they'll perform for about an hour and a half, and then you take it from there.
Well, then we end up the evening, as we always do, with our raffle drawing and the crowning of the Queen. One of the main fundraisers for the 4th of July celebration is the selling of raffle tickets, and that's how you vote for the Queen. Each year we hope to sell about 10,000 or more raffle tickets, and that's a big part of the fundraising. And then we crowned the Queen. I had the wonderful opportunity, it's been 4 or 5 years ago, but I was able for the first time to kiss the Queen. It was my daughter.
And we forgot to have the camera nearby.
So your daughter was the Queen.
She was fortunate enough to win a number of years ago. So.
Well, that's very good and a great honor for you and fun for her. And, boy, all the activities we have coming up this weekend, there's never a dull minute. And I really like the mix of talent you have and the schedule. The pace is good. Everything's going to be happening without a break. And so people can come to Slater and be entertained open-endedly with all the stuff that's going to happen. And right now it's time for a little musical interlude. We're going to, well, this is, a lot of people think this should be the national anthem because, you know, the Star Spangled Banner we played at the opening is a song with such a great range and so demanding for a singer. A lot of Americans think that this should be our national anthem. It's America the Beautiful. was beautiful. America the Beautiful, done beautifully. And I stand corrected. I said the fireworks in Ames are going to be on Saturday night. And in fact, they're going to be on Friday night. But, you know, a lot of communities will have fireworks on Saturday night. So you can go to Ames or Slater on Friday night to see the fireworks. And you're going to see a great display, whichever community it is. And I can't believe the number of dollars it costs to run fireworks. You said, oh, 12 grand, my gosh.
And one of the unique things about Slater, every one of our fireworks are lit by hand. That, my understanding is that makes our firework display somewhat unique in that our fireworks light, our firemen light each one by hand.
That's terrific, because so much of that is programmed electronically now by the professionals. Today, on this segment of the program, we're going to get a little more into what you guys are involved with also, with the Historical Society for Slater. And tell me a little bit about that, Howard. How did the society get going? And talk about Story County and how each community has their Historical Society.
Glad to do that, Paul. Now, yeah, as you could guess from our discussion here about the communities collaborating and working together on the 4th of July celebration, it actually started some years back when Shell Oil, obviously, because they were founded, 20-plus years before Slater. They have some history that goes roots deeper than Slater. But along about the late 1990s, we decided it was time to be sure we captured some of the history of our communities for the area. So about 19, we actually formed up the so-called Slater Area Historical Association. And the purpose of that area concept was that we did include Shell Oil, so we two committees could work together, and we did not encircle Huxley or Kelly or other area people that wanted to develop history organizations. So we got our charter in January of 1999. So we've been those since that time, and we have published a quarterly newsletter and have officers in place, and we think we've done a pretty good job of we are able to work locally, financing, and we do have a museum, and we got that in place about 2002. And I'll just enter in here. Bob was helpful in that no favors to us. It was all business. It was all business based. We were able to get the people across, as we mentioned, 4th of July celebration, people coming from almost the world. Well, we were able to reach out across the United States and come up with enough money to buy a $120,000 building, largely because of those communications through Shaldall and Slater, and the local Sault Ste. Bank and Trust, with Bob's help, helped us get that finance. So we burned 3 years later, no, 4 years later, we burned the mortgage. They were maybe sorry to hear that, but I guess we escaped some interest. And now the officers have led us in the short time we've existed and that we're preparing now for another fund drive. It may get to six figures. Well, I'm sure it'll get to six figures because they've already got some money coming our way through grants and et cetera. There'll be remodeling of the current building and expansion of a new building. So we're very pleased that the six directors that are now in place for the association are doing a commendable job.
My Howard, I got to interject right here, something for the FCC. It's our station break. This is KJOI 89.1 FM, Story City, Ames, and surrounding area. Now we're legal again. So you say that the tremendous things that have happened. I can't believe you burned the mortgage and early and all the community spirit that goes with that. Tell me a little bit more about, and Bob, you're involved with the Historical Society too, aren't you?
Yes, you're part of the community, so you're involved. I've been up to the facility. It's really neat to go through and see the different displays that they have. They do an excellent job. Last year at the 4th of July celebration, I don't know if they have anything special planned this year, but they had some old flour sack dish towels. I bought a number of those. They made excellent Christmas gifts, and they also had a historical book about the old Slater School. And again, I bought some of those, and I know there's at least one or two down in Arizona at some family of mine. We have some at the bank. I've had people stop in at the bank, and they look at them, and they want to buy them right there. So I have to give Howard a call and replace the ones that I have at the bank. So they've done some excellent things at the association.
Well, that's a piece of history that I'm aware of. You mentioned the flour sacks. Back during the Depression, and even into the years where I was a young boy, the flour sacks, you know, the co-op and all the people who sold seed and feed, they came in different flowered patterns. And the women would use those feed sacks to make dresses and the towels you pointed out, that sort of thing.
Aprons.
Aprons, yeah. All kinds of clothing items. It was really part of the Depression and a way for farm families to afford to clothe themselves. And I remember the tail end of that, because my dad would bring home sacks of feed, and Mom would send him back to town because they were the wrong pattern. They were not the feed sacks that blended with the garment she was making, and he would have to grumble and get back in the truck and exchange them for a different flowered pattern. And that happened many times. Oh, John, that's the wrong pattern.
Well, it turns out I was in the same boat with you on that, Paul. I was buying, when I was high school days, I was buying feed sacks. My mom gave me the same lecture when I bought the feed sacks, because she made aprons and other garments out of those matching feed sacks. So that goes back, and I should tell you that the directors in the association put together less than a year ago a very, very massive, massive apron show. And it's all been recorded, and it's all in the workbook form, so people can go back to that, pictures, etc.
You know, it's so important to preserve that, because that story I just told is almost incomprehensible to people today, that you would buy feed sacks in a pattern, and then the flowered, can you imagine these big men carrying these flowered feed sacks, you know? So this is really a great part of our history, and I think that what I get from you two folks is the fact that there's great community spirit here in causing this historical society not only to be there in place, but also growing. And it's just a tremendous community spirit. How many people are involved on the board, Howard? Is there a board?
Yeah, a six-member board, annual meeting and budgeting, and et cetera, et cetera. And now 250 members across the nation. The managers are doing a great job, and I'd be deficient. And if any of them that may be listening to this broadcast would say, Howard, you forgot to mention that it ties back to the 4th of July. They will be right in dead center, Nelson Park, under tents, and we will have film there, because there'll be for sale tote bags, magnets, a DVD we put together on Faces of the Civil War, and then another magnificent DVD that's coming into place. I believe it'll be part of it will be shown there. It goes back to the days we tore down our first school building and gymnasium and built new facilities, and that is all documented with the people involved in the community at the time.
It was a
volunteer basis to tear the old building down. It was not done by contractors.
Is that right? The community did
that. Right, 1954. Yeah, I guess nobody was insurance conscious then. Nobody got hit in the head with a 2x4.
Yeah, we took great risk then, because nobody thought you'd get sued for anything.
Correct.
Now, also, Howard, is there an association of historical societies where these different communities relate to each other?
Yeah, let's admit to the listeners that that was a lead-in question, because you know later this month there's going to be discussion, I think, by the station here about the Alliance. What's happened is, a brief of it, because they'll want to turn in and it'll be broadcast and they'll pick it up. But it turns out that Slater is one of the, with 14 communities in our county, Slater's one of the 12 organizations within the county. Huxley has their association, Collins has theirs, etc. And the first founded historical society or association in our county was Maxwell in the mid-1960s. So we've all grown, and we have great support from each of our communities as well as our county board of supervisors. So what's happening in Slater-Shellwall is happening throughout our county. So we have the preservation of history and bygone days really done well in our county.
Oh, yes, and a lot of these folks from different communities know each other, and there's you speak of the alliance.
Oh, precisely, yep. We meet as a group, representatives, two or three of us from each, or more if they want, from each of the organizations. We meet on at different settings, at different places, so we can learn from each other. And we got to the point where Story City and Ames even have paid employees on the staff. And so that we're bringing in the professionalism of advancing this history. And so this alliance meets once in spring, once in fall, representatives. There'll be 30 of us together, and we'll enjoy each other and swap stories about, well, how did you get that on? How did you do your inventory? And, well, how are you getting your funding? And where is it coming from? And how many grants is there out there we can get a hold of? And it's collaborative.
That's really great, because no one needs to reinvent the wheel. If one community or one historical society has had success doing this, that can be replicated in another community also, and they don't have to do trial and error. They can learn from what you've accomplished. Mm-hmm. And certainly, I think just talking to you and Bob today, that it's very unique how successful they've been in the historical society down there and the marvelous achievements that they've already accomplished. And I really think that our history is something that not only informs us, but also guides us into the future. Without the old Santana always said, those who do not read history are condemned to relive it. Well, you know, if you can know your history, you know a lot about what kind of inputs you need to guide your decision-making for the future, too.
Right, yeah. Right, all of that. And you're right, the collaborative exchange of information is, I suppose it's done in other counties. We always want to break up our own local settings, and we don't want, Bob and I don't want to say we put on any better festivities on 4th of July than any other community, but when we rally with each other and we learn from what do they do at Cambridge in their celebration, and what do Scandinavian Day folks do up the north end of the county. But one more thing I might say, why we've had the great support of the county supervisors is that we are unlike Jasper County and Boone County and some other counties in that they have a county association in buildings. And so it's built into their county budgets. But our supervisors have seen fit a minimal amount of money, not even as much as it costs you to buy a pickup truck today. They provide a few dollars to all of us equally so that we can sustain ourselves financially.
Well, you know, it's been so much fun doing this segment today with Howard and with Bob Krause. You know, Bob Krause sits here, he's just a ball of enthusiasm when he begins to talk about what's happening at Slater, and not only in terms of our celebration coming up on the weekend, but also the history. He just becomes very animated. Thanks for coming today, Bob Krause.
Wait till you see him in action Friday night and Saturday.
Oh, man. It's going to be one for the movies, right?
You got it.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to make some transitions here. Reminding everyone at home, you're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. And today your hosts are myself, Paul Wearson, and Howard Hammond. And for the last part of today's Local Talk show, we're going to turn to our newly established weekly installment of a new feature here at KHOI's Local Talk, offering a moment to focus on many aspects of agriculture right here in Central Iowa.
Welcome to our weekly segment, Tuning into Agriculture, heard here 89.1 FM at this time every week on KHOI's Local Talk. I'm Greta Anderson. As a rural resident of Story County, I like to be what you would call landscape literate. The farming landscape raises a lot of questions. When are those big bales of corn stover going to move? Why is that farmer's field green? It's not planting season yet. Or the question that I pursued for today's edition, what are those big windrows of white stuff doing on the fields? Oh yes, everyone has told me that's lime from the water plant. Technically, as I found out, it's lime sludge, a byproduct of the water softening process. If there are any chemistry geeks out there, you're going to love this. Here's Lyle Hammes, the superintendent of the Ames Water Treatment Plant, describing the water softening process and why it's important.
We have what we call alluvial wells. We tap into an alluvial aquifer, which is a relatively shallow aquifer. We have 22 different wells, and it's naturally there, calcium-magnesium hardness. And it comes in at about 400 milligrams per liter. We take out more than half of it. We bring it down to about 170 milligrams per liter. We just take raw water and we add the calcium hydroxide, this lime slurry, to it. You simply dump it in there, and magically or chemically, you see particles form out of what appears to be nothing. Particles do just form quite quickly, in a matter of seconds, really. And that is the chemical reaction taking place.
And Lyle demonstrated this process to me, pouring the lime, which is calcium oxide, into a tube of water, and it was kind of like a snow globe. You saw this precipitate coming down. As for the chemical reaction, here it is again.
The lime itself is calcium oxide.
CaO.
You add water to it.
H2O.
And it forms calcium hydroxide.
CaOH2.
Which binds with the chemicals, calcium bicarbonate.
CaHCO3-2, which goes on to yield CaCO3. And you've got your magnesium thrown in there, MgOH2. Iron, zinc, and even some trace heavy metal ions also precipitate out. So if you were paying attention, yes, they are adding a calcium product, CaO, to remove calcium from the water.
It seems a little counterintuitive, but that is how that works. It's all about chemistry, water treatment.
CaCO3, the end product, is basically the stuff of limestone and chalk. And limestone, ground up, is what is called agricultural lime, and it is added to fields. So if you Google lime sludge, you find that many cities around the country are having a horrible time disposing of the sludge, but not here in central Iowa. And that is because lime sludge is a benefit to farmers. It's much cheaper than the agricultural lime that a farmer might get from their co-op, which costs $30 to $35 a ton, whereas the contractor who gets paid by Ames to haul this stuff away is only charging an application fee to those who receive it. So I spoke with John Sawyer, an ISU agronomist, about why lime is beneficial for soil and plants.
The optimal pH of the soil for crop production varies by the crop, and so if it becomes too low or too acidic, then we lime the soil with limestone, or in the case we're talking today about the byproduct from Ames Municipal Water Treatment Plant. And that's also used to raise pH up to optimal levels. So for corn and soybean, which is our main two crops in Iowa, we like to see the pH roughly between 6.0 and 7.
And does regular cropping tend to bring that down?
Things under normal cropping practices like removing grain or harvesting corn stover and application of nitrogen fertilizer would be the reasons why pH would drop. And nitrogen fertilizer application is the largest push on decreasing soil pH.
Okay, so how many years can go by if a farmer is planting corn and soy in his fields in central Iowa before an application of lime of some sort is really necessary?
Yeah, there's two answers or three answers to that question on frequency of lime application need. One is the soil itself, and kind of restricting to central Iowa, we have pretty high what we call CEC soils, and those soils have high organic matter, high clay, and so they resist pH change more than, say, a soil with a lower CEC value, cation exchange capacity. And so that is one thing. The more you have that buffering, the less frequent you need to apply lime. The second would be the frequency of nitrogen application. So a field that's in continuous corn receives nitrogen fertilizer each year versus, say, corn following soybean is every other year. So the pH will decline more quickly in a continuous corn field. And then the third area would be the quality of the limestone. And something that has some mix of fines and coarser particles will hold pH longer than, say, a material that's just fine materials. And the product that comes out of the Ames water treatment plant is very fine particle size, and so it's more reactive, which means the pH can increase quicker, but it also can come down a little quicker because we don't have some of the coarser materials to hold on a longer term. So those three things together kind of have an influence on how frequent lime would be applied.
And, you know, I've also heard that calcium itself might be a micronutrient that plants need. I believe someone once told me that if my tomatoes are cracking, that means that there's not enough calcium in the soil to help them adjust to the moisture level in the soil and the changes in moisture. What say you to that?
There are 17 essential elements for plant growth and reproduction, and calcium is one of those 17. Typically, Iowa soils have plenty of calcium for crop production, but liming also, through the calcium carbonate that's applied, puts calcium into the soil, so there would be any chance of any deficiency, which would be rare, but that application, when we increase the pH, also supplies calcium, so we take care of any potential need through our liming practices. But it's very, very rare that we would have any chance to see a calcium deficiency in field crop production.
Okay. So you never really answered my question. Typically, how often should a farmer doing maybe, say, corn beans, or something like that, how often, typically, would a lime application be called for?
Okay, well, I'm not going to answer your question directly again, but we use soil testing to determine when the pH is low enough that we should lime, and so it's not something that we want people to do on a routine basis, but they should be making the application based on the need. In other words, you test the soil for soil pH. So with a good ag quality limestone, and then and probably would range anywhere from 5 to 10 years, something like that. It's going to vary, but it's not nearly as frequent as what we would do, say, for a fertilizer application. Because again, a limestone is, at least an ag quality limestone, is based to have fine particles and coarser particles, so it raises pH and helps maintain for some years. And so that's why you may not need to make an application for quite a few years.
Do you think this is an element of the production system that is sometimes forgotten about, the pH and the necessity of bringing it up?
I don't know that it's forgotten, but sometimes we fail to remember that it's one of the most important soil characteristics in relationship to nutrient management and nutrient availability to corn and soybean plants, and so it is very important. I think people pay attention to that, but routine soil testing sometimes goes by the wayside, and I think that's where you can get into trouble, that you can have a low pH and not realize that it might be having an impact.
Is there any physical signs in the growing crop that you might suspect there's a problem with pH?
Probably you would have what we call a hidden yield loss. In other words, the pH would be getting low enough that it might be having an influence on yield level before you would see some sort of coloration or physical characteristic occur. If the pH got really low, you can have symptoms show on a corn or soybean plant, but typically the pH in that case would be so low that it would have been caught well before those types of symptoms would show. So it's usually the yield decline would occur, and you wouldn't necessarily see that as a physical or visual symptom.
Can you explain a little more why it's important chemically for the pH to be up higher?
Well, what happens, or why we need the pH in that proper range, say 6 to 6.5 or towards pH 7, is a lot of chemical characteristics can influence nutrient availability, micronutrients, secondary nutrients, and as we mentioned, liming will supply calcium and magnesium, which is another essential element. And so we can have an influence on the soil chemistry, which has an influence on solubility of elements and availability. But also the pH can have a dramatic effect on soil microbial activity. And one of the prime ones is the nitrogen fixation capability of rhizobia with soybean and alfalfa. And both of those are very sensitive to low pH, and so having an optimal pH range is good for the microbial, that type of microbial community. So it's not only the chemical nature and influence on solubility and availability of nutrients, it's also the microbial community.
That's interesting. Is there anything we forgot to discuss?
No, I think you had very good questions. it's again, you know, soil pH and taking care of low pH or soil acidity is one of the fundamental soil fertility and nutrient management practices that we have. So paying attention to that is important on a long-term basis. And you've been visiting about the Ames water treatment residuals or byproducts, and that's just another good source that we have available for liming soils in this area of the state.
And that was John Sawyer, Soils Fertility Specialist in the Iowa State University Agronomy Department. It was John who pointed out to me the unexpectedness of this story. Usually these days, when folks in central Iowa think of water quality and agriculture, it's all about conflict. Removing agricultural nitrates from our drinking water is a huge hurdle that's going to require commitment on all sides. But here's a way that the needs of city folk and others for high-quality drinking water and the interests of farmers coincide with no conflict. Rather, it's a win-win situation that it's hard for anyone to argue with. Now, some farmers may be worried about those trace heavy metal contents of the product, but that is all measured very carefully by the city and by the contractor Lee Wolf Coal, and they remain well below the EPA requirements. Just a few details before we wrap up. Lee Wolf Coal, the contractor out of the Dubuque area who excavates the lime sludge from the Ames Municipal Water Plant ponds, says he spreads this chalky material on about 10,000 acres in Story County annually. He owns some ground north of Ames where the stuff sits until the fields are ready for spreading. Also, some local farmers help him out by setting aside space on their land for his piles. According to Lee, one of these cooperating farmers likes the iron content in the Ames product, which is also beneficial for crops. Our alluvial aquifers do contain a lot of iron. You don't want to wash a white car with well water. So Wolf Coal is experimenting with adding wood chips to the chalky residue to help it dry out faster, and he plans to install a concrete pad on his ground to also help with the drying process. So those are some developments to keep your eye out for as you drive I-35 south from locations north of Ames. This has been Tuning Into Agriculture with your host, Greta Anderson, and theme music by Robert Schumann, The Happy Farmer.
Was an interesting segment. That's going to be something we do very frequently here on KHOI. We're highlighting some of the developments in agriculture in the local area, and that was very interesting material. We're sorry for the glitch earlier, but that was a very good segment. And Howard, it's been a delightful day here, and Bob, I'm so glad you came to talk about the Slater Historical Society and all the events coming up on the 4th of July on Friday and Saturday as we celebrate the 4th of July here in central Iowa. And it'll be at Slater, and it'll be a great day. So, Bob, thanks for being here.
Thank you for the invite. Again, most importantly, thank you to all the veterans that have served. Those are truly the folks that we hope to honor with our celebration in Slater.
Well, that's great. That's just great. Well, this has been Local Talk. I'm Paul Wearson, your host, together with my co-host Howard Hammond. And we were just listening to this week's Tuning Into Agriculture segment that was produced by KHOI's Greta Anderson with guests Lyle Hammes, superintendent of the Ames Water Plant, and John Sawyer, the Iowa State Professor of Agronomy and Extension Specialist. Earlier in the show, we were talking about the 4th of July in the towns of Slater and Sheldon, as well as what folks are doing to keep history alive in Story County. We talked about the Slater Historical Association, the Area Historical Association, with the help of Bob Krause, who joined us here in the studio.
Yeah, and Paul, we were pleased here that we had the engineering done by Jonah DeKeest, who's done a very capable job, I would say. And you've been hearing the information from the CD, and the other inserts you had on this program had to do with the playing of the Star Spangled Banner by the United States Army Old Guard Fife and Drum Corps, as well as American The Beautiful, done by the United States Air Force Band. And, of course, the theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley.
A reminder that Local Talk is aired on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. You can also listen to this and all of our Local Talk shows online at our website, which is khoifm.org. Now that's khoifm.org. You will also find lists of our guests and contact information to the organizations as we speak with them. And other resources are also mentioned on our shows. If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop, as well as a radio show. If you'd like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878, 292-2878, or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. Your participation as an audience makes KHOI possible. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.
On the radio, right. That's it. Yeah, see you again on the radio.
That's called duo.
Yeah, right.